Welcome to this meeting that's hosted by the Consistent Democrats to study Trotsky's Revolution Betrayed. And we're on chapter 9 now, the first part, the introduction, which doesn't actually have a proper subtitle to it, but it is the introductory section. And so I'll talk about that for a while, and we can have some discussion on it, if that's okay with comrades. Yeah, so
Absolutely.
this is about the introductory section of this chapter, which ought to add another layer to our understanding of the character of the Soviet Union under the bureaucracy that really rose to power in the early 20s, or the mid 20s, I should say, the beginnings of it anyway. And it's a preparation for later sections of this chapter, which they address some of the complex questions that caused major political problems for the Trotskyist movement as conflicts heated up between the degenerated USSR and imperialism in more recent times. And it's one thing to fight hard to defend a state which the movement considers to be led by good communists, by internationalists, revolutionaries, etc. And it's quite another to have the clear-sightedness to understand the need to defend a state that clearly embodied gains for the working class, but at the same time was led by forces that were increasingly hostile to the revolutionary movement, and even used mass repression to attempt to defeat it. And clarifying what had to be defended and what had to be rejected, and how to defend and remedy those things is of crucial importance. And those are the questions that this chapter addresses, the character of the USSR in some theoretical depth. So the introduction sets the scene with some observations about the economics of the degenerating USSR and social and economic inequality. And first of all, it deals with the contradiction between the formally increasing statification of various aspects of the economy of the USSR and the real material content of those changes in terms of progress, real or alleged, towards socialism. And this focuses on the contradictions we've explored when discussing earlier chapters, such as those between proletarian relations of production, formal economic planning, etc., and bourgeois relations of distribution. So in that regard, Trotsky examines the apparent statification of the USSR's economy and goes through some of the raw figures, quoting the official optimism about them. And he writes this. He writes, according to the census of 1934, 28.1% of the population were workers and employees of state enterprises and institutions. Industrial and building trades workers, not including their families, amounted in 1935 to 7.5 millions. The collective farms and cooperative crafts comprised, at the time of the census, 45.9% of the population. Students, soldiers of the Red Army, pensioners, and other elements directly dependent upon the state made up 3.4%. Altogether, 74% of the population belonged to the socialist sector, so-called, and 95.8% of the basic capital of the country fell to the share of this 74%. Individual peasants and craftsmen still comprised, in 1934, 22.5%, but they had possession of only a little more than 4% of the national capital. And he goes on, since 1934, there's been no census. The next one will be in 1937. Undoubtedly, however, during the last 2 years, the private enterprise sector has shrunk still more in favour of the socialist sector, that is. Individual peasants and craftsmen, according to the calculations of official economists, now constitute about 10% of the population. That is about 17 million people. Their economic importance has fallen very much lower than their numbers. The Secretary of the Central Committee, Andreev, announced in April 36 that the relative weight of socialist production in our country in 1936 ought to reach 98.5%. That is to say, something like an insignificant 1.5% still belongs to the non-socialist sector. Interesting. But then Trotsky sounds a huge note of caution about this. He writes this, he says, "These optimistic figures seem at first glance an unanswerable proof of the so-called final and irrevocable victory of socialism. But woe to him who cannot see social reality behind arithmetic." And almost immediately, he begins addressing what this means in practice, given the current levels of material, current at that time anyway, of material development of the USSR. And he writes this, he says, "The enormous and wholly indubitable statistical superiority of the state and collective forms of economy, important though it is for the future, does not remove another and no less important question, that of the strength of bourgeois tendencies within the socialist sector itself, and this not only in agriculture, but in industry. The material level already attained is high enough to awaken increased demands in all, but wholly insufficient to satisfy them. Therefore, the very dynamic of economic progress involves an awakening of petty bourgeois appetites, not only among the peasants and representatives of intellectual labour, but also among the upper circles of the proletariat. A bare antithesis between individual proprietors and collective farmers, between private craftsmen and state industries, does not give the slightest idea of the explosive power of these appetites, which imbue the whole economy of the country and express themselves, generally speaking, in the desire of each and every one of us, of them, to give as little as possible to society and receive as much as possible from it." So, it should be understood that this is not about the moral failings of individuals, or even of whole layers or classes of the population. It's about productive capacity, the presence or absence of the material basis to achieve social and economic equality, and thus social and political stability around a would-be socialist project. So he writes this, he writes, "No less energy and ingenuity is being spent in solving money grubbers and consumers' problems than on socialist construction in the proper sense of the word. Hence derives, in part, the extremely low productivity of social labour. While the state finds itself in continual struggle with the molecular action of these centrifugal forces, the ruling group itself forms the chief reservoir of legal and illegal personal accumulations. Masked as they are with new juridical norms, the petty bourgeois tendencies cannot, of course, be easily determined statistically, but their actual predominance in economic life is proved primarily by the socialist bureaucracy, that flagrant contradiction in terms," he actually uses an Italian phrase, but that's what it means, "that monstrous and continually growing social distortion, which in turn becomes the source of malignant growths in society." And on that line, he dissected the Stalin Constitution of 1936, which made the assertion that the state property is the property of the whole people. And he explores the question of bourgeois norms of distribution and how they impact on this property of the whole people, that is, state property in the means of production. And he basically goes into the point that the real character of state property and its development into socialist property represents what Trotsky in this section calls the dialectic of interaction. And he goes on, he says this, he says, "State property becomes the property of the whole people only to the degree that social privilege and differentiation disappear, and therewith the necessity of the state. In other words, state property is converted into socialist property in proportion as it ceases to be state property. And the contrary is true. The higher the Soviet state rises above the people, and the more fiercely it opposes itself as the guardian of property to the people as its squanderer, the more obviously does it testify against the socialist character of this state property. And he points out that the Soviet press, the official press, was compelled to abolish, to acknowledge some of this, and it said, in saying that we are still far from the complete abolition of classes. It was referring to the existing differentiation of city and country, of intellectual and physical labour. And they talked about what they call survivals of the old inequality. But this concealed the income of the bureaucracy under the category of intellectual labour. And therefore, as he put it, these much put upon survivals are completely inadequate to explain the Soviet reality. If the differences between city and country have been mitigated in certain respects, in others they have been considerably deepened, thanks to the extraordinarily swift growth of cities and city culture, that is, of comforts for an urban minority. The social distance between physical and intellectual labour, notwithstanding the filling out of the scientific cadres by newcomers from below, has increased, not decreased, during recent years. The thousand-year-old caste barriers defining the life of every man on all sides, the polished urbanite and the uncouth muzhik, that's the Russian peasant, the wizard of science and the day labourer, have not just been preserved from the past in a more or less softened form, but have to a considerable degree been born anew and are assuming a more and more defiant character. And he evokes the slogan that he echoed from the top of the bureaucratic regime, that the cadres decide everything. The cult of the cadres being a cult of bureaucracy, in Trotsky's words, of officialdom, an aristocracy of technique. And thus, formally, in terms of ownership of the means of production, there is equality between a marshal and a servant girl, the head of a trust and a day labourer, the son of a people's commissar and a homeless child. But, and it's a big but, he says, nevertheless, the former occupy lordly apartments, enjoy several summer homes in various parts of the country, have the best automobiles at their disposal, and have long ago forgotten how to shine their own shoes. The latter live in wooden barracks, often without partitions, lead a half-hungry existence, and do not shine their own shoes only because they go barefoot. To the bureaucrat, this difference does not seem worthy of attention. To the day labourer, it seems, not without reason, very essential. And then he concretizes the dialectic that's referred to earlier. And he says this, he says, the destiny of the state-appropriated means of production will be decided in the long run according as these differences in personal existence evolve in one direction or another. If a ship is declared as collective property, but the passengers continue to be divided into first, second and third class, it's clear that for the third class passengers, differences in the conditions of life will have infinitely more importance than that juridical change in proprietorship. The first class passengers, on the other hand, will propound, together with their coffee and cigars, the thought that collective ownership is everything and a comfortable cabin nothing at all. Antagonisms growing out of this may well explode the unstable collective. And he fleshes this out in terms of a similar set of formulas in some ways to those often used by Karl Marx in Capital, this time to explain the influence of bourgeois norms of distribution on the worker's state, not production. But he sets the scene in this way. He says, if we translate socialist relations for illustration into the language of the market, we may represent the citizen as a stockholder in the company which owns the wealth of the country. If the property belonged to all the people, this would presume an equal distribution of shares, in quotes, and consequently the right to the same dividend for all shareholders, in quotes. The citizens participate in the national enterprise, however, not only as shareholders, but also as producers. And then he works through the implications of that. He talks about how, with the lower stage of communism, which we also call socialism, payments for labour are made according to bourgeois norms. That is, dependence on the skill and intensity of the worker, the skill of the worker, the intensity of the work, etc. And he divides the theoretical income of each citizen into two parts. That is, the dividend from ownership, which is designated with the letter A, and wages, which are designated with the letter B. So the total income for a worker in a worker's state on the road to socialism will be A plus B. And he points out this, that the higher the technique and the more complete the organisation of industry, the greater is the place occupied by A, that is the share holding, as against B, which is the wages. And the less is the influence of individual differences of labour upon the standard of living. But there's the rub, you see, because it doesn't work like that in the USSR. Because, as he points out, from the fact that wage differences in the Soviet Union are a lot less, but greater than in capitalist countries, it must be inferred that the shares of the Soviet citizen are not equally distributed, and that in his income, the dividend as well as the wage payment are unequal. Whereas the unskilled labourer receives only B, that is wages, the minimum payments under similar conditions he would receive in a capitalist enterprise, the Stakhanovist or bureaucrat receives 2A, that's twice the dividend, plus B, that's plus his wages, or it could be 3A plus B, etc. While B, in its term, that's wages, may become 2B or 3B, etc. The differences in income are determined, in other words, not only by differences of individual productivity, but also by a masked appropriation of the products of the labour of others. The privileged minority of shareholders is living at the expense of the deprived majority. And he goes on to say this. He says, if you assume that the Soviet unskilled worker receives more than he would under a similar level of technique and culture in a capitalist enterprise, that is to say that he's still a small shareholder, it's necessary to consider his wages as equal to A plus B. But the wages of the higher categories will be expressed with the formula 3A plus 2B or 10A plus 15B, etc. It means that the unskilled worker has one share, the Stakhanovist has three, the specialist has 10. Moreover, their wages in the proper sense are related in the ratio as 1 to 2 to 15 or something like that. And so he concludes from all this, from all these figures, which are somewhat fiddly to say the least. He says this. He says that hymns to the sacred socialist property sound under these conditions a good deal more convincing to the manager or the Stakhanovist than to the rank and file worker or collective peasant. The rank and file workers, however, are the overwhelming majority of society. It was they, and not the new aristocracy, that socialism had in mind. And so, as he points out, that when Pravda wrote this, it wrote, the worker in our country is not a wage slave, and he is not the subseller of a commodity called labour power. He's a free workman. But when it wrote that, it was just bragging impermissibly. It's not true. You know, the workers' state's capacity to really liberate the worker from economic slavery depends upon the development of a basic level of technique. As he points out, he says, in order to raise this level, the new state resorted to the old methods of pressure upon the muscles and nerves of the worker. There grew up a corps of slave drivers. The management of industry became super bureaucratic. The workers lost all influence, whatever, upon the management of the factory. With piecework payment, hard conditions of material existence, lack of free movement, with terrible police repression penetrating the life of every factory, It is hard indeed for the worker to feel himself a free workman. In the bureaucracy, he sees the manager. In the state, the employer. Free labour is incompatible with the existence of a bureaucratic state. And though this addresses mainly the situation in the towns, Trotsky noted that a similar contradiction between form and social content occurred in the countryside. So he notes that, he says this, he says, Pravda writes that the collective farms, in quotes, are in essence already of the same type as the state enterprises and are consequently socialistic. But immediately adds that the guarantee of the socialist development of agriculture lies in the circumstance that the Bolshevik Party administers the collective farms. But as he said, this means, and just quoting again, he says that this means that in essence, the socialist relations are not as yet embodied in the real relations among men, but dwell in the benevolent hearts of the authorities. The workers will do very well if they keep a watchful eye on that heart. In reality, the collective farms stand halfway between individual and state economy, and the petty bourgeois tendencies within them are admirably helped along by the swiftly growing private allotments or personal economies conducted by their members. And so he concludes this section. We've got quite a substantial passage, which I will quote because it's actually, it actually sort of draws it all together. I'll quote the whole thing and I'll finish. And what he writes is this. He writes, but when the new constitution announces that in the Soviet Union, abolition of man by man has abolition of the exploitation of man by man has been attained, it's not telling the truth. The new social differentiation has created conditions for the revival of the exploitation of man in its most barbarous forms, that of buying him into slavery for personal service. In the lists for the new census, personal servants are not mentioned at all. They are evidently to be dissolved in the general group of workers. However, there are plenty of questions about this. Does the socialist citizen have servants? And just how many? Maid, cook, nurse, governess, chauffeur? Does he have an automobile at his personal disposal? How many rooms does he occupy, etc.? Not a word in these lists about the scale of earnings. If the rule were revived that exploitation of the labour of others deprived one of political rights, it would turn out, somewhat unexpectedly, that the cream of the ruling group were outside the bounds of the Soviet constitution. Fortunately, they've established a complete equality of rights for servant and master. Two opposite tendencies are growing up out of the depth of the Soviet regime. To the extent that, in contrast to a decay in capitalism, it develops the productive forces, is preparing the economic basis of socialism. To the extent that, for the benefit of an upper stratum, it carries to more and more extreme expression bourgeois norms of distribution, is preparing a capitalist restoration. The contrast between forms of property and norms of distribution cannot grow indefinitely. Either the bourgeois norm must in one form or another spread to the means of production, or the norms of distribution must be brought into correspondence with the socialist property system. And that's his conclusion for that point, for that section. I will leave it there, and people want to discuss that, hopefully. Thank you, comrades. Who wants to speak on this?
Thank you.
Cheers. I'm going to speak for about half an hour. Who wants to speak on this?
Well, I'll speak then, eh? Because nobody else is volunteering just now. Jonathan, were you thinking of doing it? No, okay, because I could see you were trying and perhaps not making it. Okay, so yeah, I agree with your introduction, Jan. I think this is a super important It was a small chapter comparatively, but I found it very wide and large in meaning and significance, because at the very end it says, people who watch the Soviet Union, all they see is Soviet Union lifeless, talentless, and false. And myself, I have lived most of my militant life when the Soviet Union was around, and you could say that of the Soviet Union completely. And when people around me were moved in a socialist direction, well, they didn't think much of the Soviet Union, and certainly had a lot of rancor towards it. There was a lot of Trotskyists around me, but nobody was able to actually sum it up like Trotsky does in this chapter. And so this situation in which, I think if I understood correctly, in which there is unequal distribution in the first worker state, if I understood this correctly, is due to the fact that you are not going to have socialism just in that little place, little comparatively with the world. It is not possible. And so through scientific thinking, which was the thinking of Trotsky, he could see that from the very beginning, without even knowing anything about how Stalin was going to develop or whether there would be a Stalin. He knew, and Lenin and him knew that you could not aim at advanced form of socialism and then the beginning of communism in Russia or Soviet Union only. This is a scientific fact. The science of that fact is explained in this document, where he shows in detail the problems. What are the objective problems? So he talks about, you are in a state where apparently everybody owns everything, so you are a stakeholder in the state. So you get a wage and a dividend, he says, but likely that your wage and your dividend are not much more than the average wage as it would be in the capitalist system. Meanwhile, like Ian said, the Stakhanovists and all these officials and people who are in positions of control receive an increase in the wage, an increase in the dividend. So those, that is concealed because everybody's supposed to have to be a stakeholder. The person in charge, or the intellectual, because apparently to be in the bureaucracy was part of being an intellectual, which is quite comical. This meant the difference in income was determined not only by differences of individual productiveness, but also by a masked appropriation of the products of the labor of others. And I think this is a little key to the text, in the sense that, well, if there is going to be a real objective reason for unequal distribution, let's look at it. Let's admit it, let's explain it, and so that the masses participate and understand why it is like this. But here it is masked, the masked appropriation of the product of the labor of others. And this is not socialism, and it is one of the actions, main actions, through which capital gets accumulated. From the labor of others, the labor of workers particularly. So I think in that phrase you see the content, that there is a continuation of something which is happening in the capitalist system, which is a norm in the capitalist system, and which here is not explicited, and which is voluntarily hidden. So why we have seen that before? Why do the leadership, the bureaucratic leadership of the Soviet Union, hide this with such a care, such an obstination? So is it because the distribution cannot be any other way, but if you admit to it, you can no longer hide behind the necessary lack of equality. You can no longer hide behind its necessity, the fact that you are doing well out of it as well. And this is not a complaint from the part of Trotsky. It's not to have a go at Stalin or anything. It is to restore and to uphold the principles of the revolution, because this is what is at stake here. The revolution established that there would be equality that people could not exploit others, and you could not exploit a servant. So you could not bind somebody, a human being, to your individual need, like Ian mentioned, the nurse, the chauffeur, the governess. All these are against the Soviet Constitution, as decreed in 1917 or 18. And so, well, the reason why this is not explicited by the Soviet leadership was that because they hide behind this in order to continue themselves the same sort of thing beyond what is actually necessary. So the lie gets perpetuated that not all contributions to building society are deserving of an equal share of its returns. This is me, my own formulation. One's contribution is still assessed, as was in the capitalist regime, in money or in status terms, like you are, you know, the leader of a trust or somebody in the government, not in terms of one's own participation to the task of building society. And so I think this, I'm going to conclude here, that I think even though there was not the conditions to have equal distribution, there was the condition, and there still is now in all the worker states, the conditions to become aware of this. And I think we should link this with the importance that was given in another of our meetings about the importance of consciousness. Consciousness is the way by which these things can be not overcome, but they can be faced with programs and policies to actually moderate them and to put them, to make them serve the common good, to put them at the service of an advance towards the common good, and to base oneself on the consciousness that people are not stupid and that they will understand when there is a problem and will continue to support the effort of the revolution. So, I'll come back on another point later.
Right. Who else wants to speak? Anybody?
Come on, Suzanne, you defend anarchy.
I don't think that's true.
Are you still there, Suzanne?
Sorry, I muted myself. Okay. Why is there a rejection of an equal dividend for all? Surely all people are participants within the Soviet, within the... Why is there no equal shares? Why is it that there is some sort of ranking system that... And, you know, I'm not disputing Trotsky's identification that bureaucracy will tend to reward itself. You know, I mean, that's true of capitalism. But it seems to me that that's a capitalist system, that the conviction that your contribution to society is always somehow superior to those of others, particularly, it doesn't really matter whether it's you're an academic and you think somehow brain work is harder than, you know, skilled labor or just brute labor, forgetting that you are not putting yourself in danger of incapacity or losing your life or health or whatever. I don't understand why there is not an assumption of equality of dividends. Why does not everybody expect to receive an equal dividend? Yeah. But maybe I'm being too simplistic, you know. Is that the hang up from the patriarchal and feudalism of Russian society beforehand, or is it? Because one of the things that did impress me was you'd said about after the revolution, women were paid equally to men, that there was much more, you know, that there was recognition of that. And I'm sure that's part of what spurred, if you like, women's suffrage in the West, was women were given the vote where they needed white women to bolster up the white male vote in the colonies, which is why you get, you know, women's suffrage in New Zealand and Australia before you get it in Britain. But it's also the case that you get women's suffrages comes later than in Russia. Yes, where it was a case of women, you know, men and women voted got the vote equally. So I'm just asking, why wasn't Trotsky advocating an equal dividend for all, a recognition of, you know, it is the hammer and the sickle. Yes, it is the peasant and the worker, the recognition that they are all workers.
Can I come back on this? Because I actually think Trotsky...
Sorry, I had to elaborate so much, but yes.
I think Trotsky is advocating equality, that's the point. But he's pointing out what's actually happening in practice is not that. I mean, it's not just Trotsky, it's Lenin. If you read The State and Revolution, Lenin makes the point, the basic point is that before you get to socialism, and actually socialism itself as opposed to communism, you have the regime of bourgeois right, where you've abolished bourgeois relations of production, but the economy will not work, at least in its earlier stages, without some level of inequality because of technical specialisms and things like this, that you need to actually increase the productive power of the economy to the point that differences in formal differences in remuneration become irrelevant, because everybody can take as much as they want. You know, that's the slogan of developed communism, is from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. So basically, you've got enough to give everything to everybody. And there's no, you know, it doesn't matter if people are unequal, because everybody can take what they need, right? And don't have to worry about whether they're unequal, whether they're equal or unequal with anybody else, because effectively that is equality, because no one cares about whether it's equal or unequal anymore, because nobody is suffering from deprivation and oppression, etc. Because of that, it becomes a communal store that everybody can take as much as they like, and there's no incentive as there is under capitalism to grab as much as you can get. You know, there's no point in that. That motivation doesn't exist, because profit motive doesn't exist. You know, before you get to that point, you have to expand the productive capacity of the economy. And when you're starting off, the lower the level you're starting off from, the more severe are the tasks of expanding the productive forces to get to where you want to go, right? And that's the contradiction of the USSR, because it was more backward than most of the capitalist world, because Russia was a underdeveloped feudal economy up until February 1917. It was a feudal regime, although the feudal czarists had actually taken measures to industrialize and had borrowed elements of capitalist technique and elements of capitalism. It was still a very backward capitalism. So even in the advanced capitalist world, you have a period of transition to socialism. And socialism and communism ultimately communism means where that abundance is to such an extent that inequality becomes irrelevant. It becomes no longer inequality, right? But when you develop...
No, I don't. And I was going to say that what cuts across it, and I do want you to address that, is the Tsar, certainly Alexander the First and Alexander the Second, started the train system, particularly the Trans-Siberian Railway. And I think we, uniquely in the sort of 21st century, are looking at resources. It wasn't simply about agriculture as food and resources, but Russia is a country blessed with an infinite, for want of a better word, amount of resources, particularly coal, steel, iron ore, metals. It wasn't, you know, gold, precious jewels, precious metals. It had resources that only, I think, the countries of Africa could have been compared with. And yet, it seems the focus of both Lenin and Trotsky is all on production, as if somehow they've got to make goods in order to take part in, as they saw it, the Industrial Revolution. Whereas it seems to me that they could continue with production, particularly of, you know, minerals and oil and gas and the other resources of their absolutely vast country. You know, it was the sixth of the planet. Yes, and it was even bigger before they sold Siberia, you know, before they sold Alaska to America, wasn't it?
Yeah, but they didn't have the productive forces to actually make use of that.
But that's why the British Empire was so upset about the Russian Empire with the Trans-Siberian Railway, because they were afraid that they would send those resources straight to America and America would use it for its industrialization, and that threatened the British Empire's state. That's why the British Empire, if you like, fell back on relying on its total control of its colonies and, you know, selling back the industrial goods that we made.
Mm.
Yes? You know, the flaw, it seems, in the argument is that Russia set itself to compete with the British Empire to industrialize when it could have relied on its mineral resources and industrialized organically out of the fact that it would be more efficient to use some of those resources to industrialize itself. And that would have given them a much more equal society.
Where would the technology have come from? That's the question.
The technology grows of itself. It's like education. Where does it come from? It comes from learning.
Maybe. But I think you have to build certain things, prerequisites. I mean, even railways, you have to build them. You have to have the steam. Okay.
But they were building them. I mean, you know, that was part of the Tsarist investment, if you like, because of the absolutely massive, you know, gold and mineral reserves that they had, wasn't it?
Yeah. But I still think they didn't have there were special projects that were done for the benefit of the Tsar. But did they actually raise the standard of living of the whole people?
But they raised it for... It was what they were building and selling that was important.
Maybe, yes. But I mean, you look at the standard of living of workers in the West, even then, it was far, far in advance of the...
Yeah, but that was because we were living off... I mean, if you looked at the... If you averaged out the standard of living across the British Empire, you know... The only reason that British workers appeared to have a good standard of living was that it was the appalling standard of living in the colonies.
Still greater than in Russia as well, though, which was not a colony as such. country.
Well, it was an internal empire. Of, yes?
Sorry, Diana wants to speak.
Yeah, sorry, Diana.
I sort of have a problem with the obsession with industrialization, because you don't need advanced industry to live. There are parts of that USSR region still has indigenous populations, and indigenous populations wouldn't be deprived. But one reason why Russia would have to industrialize is because it was under attack from everywhere else. And so you need that industrialization to create an arms industry and for them to arm themselves. Now, that in principle horrifies me. I'm, you know, very against all the arms industry and stuff, but they would have no choice because they were under permanent attack. They were under attack right from the time of the revolution. Mm-hmm. And then under attack, under attack potentially with the Second World War. So without industrialization, they would have just been taken over like the colonies in Africa. So,
but if you
there were flaws in maybe flaws in the way the USSR did sort of try to advance industrially, but it didn't have any other choice but to do that. The other thing is that for advanced industrialization, a high level of scientific and technical education is essential. And they were isolated mostly by the more industrially advanced countries outside. They had to educate their own people. I don't know how well they did that. I do know, I am aware of cooperation between the USSR and the rest of the bits of the world certainly with mathematics and presumably with science generally.
Although yeah, that's what I was going
to say. And I'm not sure how good that was. Let me finish. Yeah. Hang on. One of the reasons why I'm aware of that is because students of my generation who were studying math and science also had the opportunity, some of them, I regret that, to learn Russian. And that was because then you could then read about the mathematical and science research that was going on in Russia. I think I've probably said as much as I need to.
Okay, if I can jump in. I mean, I vividly remember reading, you know, it's the 19th century, the 1850s, 1860s, right the way through to the 19th. And this is where the Russian USSR built on this massive scientific progress that Russia made, particularly the educated classes, because, you know, we're not just, you know, the atomic table, the Mendeleev, that's the 1860s. Oh. You know, Russian science was part of the cutting edge. This is why I can't understand the, you know, where did the technology came from? It came from within, because they were part of, you know, the intelligentsia, the academia, the cities. It was, the real problem was the cities expanded and became richer and became wealth. And, you know, the Tsars did import, you know, there's the famous, isn't it? is it Crimea where there are Welsh speakers, because they literally bought, you know, into an entire Welsh factory and took it, and you know, to learn the iron processing to make their own weapons. But you know, the British Empire was starting to attack Russia. Yes, they teamed up with the Turkish Ottoman Empire to attack Russia for Crimea, and then they teamed up with, you know, Russia to attack the Ottoman Empire later on to take it back. The whole thing is about divide and conquer, and Russia was on the receiving end of that from about the 1820s, 30s onwards, because Russia had huge amounts of coal, but the British Empire relied on its ships, whereas Russia, by building this Trans-Siberian Railway, was going to free itself. It was going to be a land bridge, yes, to where the money, the population that was expanding, if you like, the financial push was going towards America. And the British Empire was scared that Russia would be the, you know, would be the resource. In the same way that this is why they were desperate to control the Middle East. This is why France and Britain got together to try and control the Middle East. No? And I'm afraid the Russians wanted, you know, that the Tsarist Russia wanted a fleet. This is all about, you know, this is all about who's not aircraft carriers at that time, but their gunboat diplomacy, which had shredded the Chinese empire in the 1850s and 60s and 70s. And the British Empire, the imperialists there were just looking for another massive, overblown, as they saw it, empire that they could dismember and loot. And having done so to China and the Far East, they were, you know, they'd already gutted India, and Russia was the next on their list because it was seen as backward, and you know, the Slavs were as uncultured and barbaric as they saw. You know, it's entirely about racism, no?
Well, it's certainly racist. Yeah.
You know,
there is racism involved, but yes, that doesn't mean that the backwardness. Yes, there was a Russian intelligentsia that was advanced in certain spheres, and that's no doubt true. But there was still a huge, very, very backward peasant population that had been sort of, you know, transformed in other in Western Europe, particularly, more so anyway, you know, into an industrial working class that had a much higher standard of living, which was much more productive. And yeah, I mean, the military question is absolutely crucial, because you cannot maintain a socialist or socialist inclined worker state indefinitely if your productive forces are qualitatively lower than your capitalist opponents. And so they had no choice really but to try to sort of catch up and compete with their imperialist opponents, you know. And that necessarily, I mean, if we didn't live in a world of imperialist war, things might work out differently, and you might be able to do things at a more sedate pace, possibly true. But that's not the world we live in, is it? You know, in 1917, after 1917 revolution, from 1918 onward, Russia was invaded by about a dozen or more armies, you know. Various different directions. It had to fend that off. It was a very, very difficult task. And then even when it had fended them off, and it took 4 years, right, it nevertheless had to maintain that fending off for an extended period. Really, I mean, you know, Hitler was the super Rangel, as Trotsky said, the White Guards on a massive international scale, you know.
Marie's written a comment about Russia was feudal. Russia wasn't strictly speaking feudal, because the the serfs were freed in, I think, 1861, 63. The real problem was that they had done a deal with the, you know, the ultra-rich, the serf-owning class, who had to work for 50 years to pay off the debt of their slavery, in the same way that, you know, abolition of slavery, the working class, you know, you might just as well say, well, the British working class were feudal because it took them till 2015 to pay off the debt for the abolition of slavery in 1863 or whatever it was. No, you know, the debt is what gave Russia the appearance of feudalism. It wasn't the actual condition of serfdom. No?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are things in between, aren't there? They abolished there's still, you know, huge peasantry that didn't have access to the land, you know, and large landowners that in practice managed to enforce their will on very, very large.
Well, they owned the legal system, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So, you know, it's one thing being given your rights and your land back. I know, but you had enlightened landowners like Kropotkin, who was Tsar Prince Kropotkin, who gave the peasants the land along with their freedom when he freed the peasants that he, the serfs that he technically owned. Yes, and earned his living by writing and traveling about. But he was a rarity as far as I understand.
Yes, indeed.
Those landowners were far more, as you say, astute in basically forcing those peasants that they could back into debt slavery so that they could buy up their land at knockdown prices afterwards.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So in reality, the point is that a huge element of the population were impoverished, and the industrial working class were a minority of the population, which is not true in Britain or in a number of the more.
I think you understand more about Russia's problems if you compare them with India's.
Yeah,
and I would say Russia is, you know, well, because of the way in which we left, you know, a society that was caste driven, but also comfortable with the debt slavery of, you know, the untouchable class, the bottom three classes who were so horrifically oppressed by the upper two classes, the Brahmins and I forget what the second one is called, but the caste system itself. It feels like is more similar to what Trotsky is complaining about. Yeah, that in a sense the bureaucracy is what it, you know, we can call it a class system, but it's more like a caste system, that nepotism and cronyism ensures that the children of bureaucrats become the civil service of the next year, that take up the places of education, that ensure that they get the opportunities. As they said, they get the best cars, they are, you know, they have the best land, and they have multiple houses. Why? Because they know when they're going on sale and when they can pick them up cheap. You know, they perpetuate their wealth and they entrench it, which then becomes the ruling class that socialism and communism are trying to get rid of.
Well, they don't really become the ruling class because they don't own the means of production. That's the thing. This is what's being pointed out, really, is that what you've got is a thing that's trying to, it has a socialist element in it. It's trying to expand the process of production to actually bring things up to a higher level in comparison with its opponents, its armed opponents in the rest of the world, but not in the rest of the world, in the imperialist world, I should say, the external threatening world, you know. But that is objectively necessary. It is necessary to actually expand the productive capacity of the economy simply for survival reasons, apart from everything else. It's not capitalist competition, but it's armed conflict with capitalists, right? But as a result of that process, you get a situation where the apparatus that's used to try and do that can escape the control of the working class. And that's what actually happened. That's what the degeneration of the Soviet Union actually was. It is the productive capacity, the productive apparatus, or the administrative apparatus, I should say, its purpose was to drive the expansion of production to allow the Soviet Union to keep compete and to fend off its enemies. Obviously such an apparatus would need to be an element of inequality to actually get the technical specialisms and whatever to industrialize, right, and to develop that feature, that technological basis. But there is always a danger that apparatus could escape the control of the working class. And that's what Trotsky was talking about. As I said, Lenin's State and Revolution talks about this. He says that basically, in these conditions, you need a bourgeois state without the bourgeoisie to actually administer the various inequalities that are necessary to drive the technical enhancement of the economy, et cetera, the productive expansion of the economy. And at a certain level of expansion, when there's enough available to actually provide a privileged lifestyle to some of the population, but not to give a decent standard of living to all of the population, you get this phenomenon of a minority of the population tries to grab as much as it can, you know. And that's what he's referring to in this text, actually, you know. That this is not capitalism, but it's a byproduct of the backwardness of a socialist economy when it doesn't have the material resources to satisfy the basic needs of everybody. So you get a minority that will try to grab as much as possible as it can for itself as part of the process of expanding the means of production and the productive capacity of the economy. And if you don't control that, you end up with, well, you end up with Stalinism. You end up with a productive apparatus, an administrative apparatus that's got out of the control of the working class. And it's not the same thing as capitalist restoration, but there is a threat of that in there, you know, that these people could go further and say, privileges out of our administrative positions. We want property as well, you know, and that's the danger. And that's what eventually did happen, of course. You know, but it took a lot longer than Trotsky thought it might. It went on after the Second World War for about 40-odd years or more, you know. But in the end, that is what did happen, you know. But, you know, that was a threat that was seen. You know, when he's talking about these dividends and wages, etc., they're actually somewhat metaphorical. They're to illustrate the principle of the question. I'm sure it's much more complex than that, even, you know. But he's examining the phenomenon and trying to put it into manageable, you know, the conceptually manageable chunks and explain the issue, you know. But I'm sure it's more complex than even he was talking about in terms of the dividend relations and all this, dividends and wages and multiples of dividends and multiples of wages, etc., etc., etc. But the basic point is that this apparatus is a danger to the worker state, but it's also necessary because you can't expand the productive capacity of the worker state without it. You can't just abolish the state. You have to build the material means in which the state withers away. And unfortunately, the more backward you start, the economy is, you know, the worker state is relative to its opponents, the more sharp that contradiction is, and the more dangerous that bourgeois state without the bourgeoisie is to the working class and to the worker state. That's his point, I think. You know. Anyway, sorry, I'm rabbiting on too much. Anybody else want to? Anybody else want to speak?
My concern is that there is, I was saying corporate capitalism, but capitalism creates poverty, creates shortages, creates the, because without austerity or the it's the threat of homelessness, of, you know, total destitution that persuades people to work harder than is good for them. Yes, and it's also, it's financial capitalism. There is this vast bureaucracy of, in effect, it's laundering the money that ensures that workers do not receive the benefits of the production. You know, the reason why do workers need to control the means of production in order to be able to ensure, it's to ensure that they'll receive the true profits of their labors. And you cannot, because at the end of the day, you know, finance is a criminal effort. You've only got to look at America now to see that there is no part of the financial world, whether it's banking, insurance, or, you know, all of it is actually a Ponzi scheme. It is all crooked. And the legal system is there to enforce the crooked so that it gives a pretense that, you know, it's rules for thee and not for me. It's entirely about evading accountability. You know, why do we have limited liability companies? It's because the people who create the crash, you know, the bust after the boom, who do not want to have to pay for it. They want to be able to walk away without the debt. Sorry, Marie, you've got your hand up.
Sorry, you've got the right to speak.
Well, yes, but not to go on too long.
I put my hand up so that you would give way.
I would know that you had something to say that was, yes, that's fine. And I agree with you totally.
What I mean to say is, I'm not so sure I know all about it, but I'm going to try. Yeah? I see a bit in this document which says that distribution of wealth is not a factor secondary to its production. I mean, that looks obvious, but one can actually start discussing distribution in any country, whereas here we are talking about distribution in a certain situation of production in a country which has not been able to develop the means of production. This is why it was not a major capitalist country. It was a feudal country which was with aspect of, you know, like I think Ian said it in the beginning, with aspects where there had been aspects of attempts at capitalist development in Russia, but it was a feudal state. It had been the most backward of the backwards, and yet, of course, it was rich. But this was discovered also, including the oil, much later, and we are talking here about a production system which is now in the hand of the state, because capitalism, in its contradiction, was not able to give a capitalist turn to that 1917. 1917, it was a revolution which eliminated the possibility of capitalism. And this, I think, is linked with this question. So we cannot discuss now what happened in Russia or in the Soviet Union as if it was just like India or like France or Germany or something. There is a qualitative change, the difference, in the sense that when people, I think it says in the text, when people who had been in the revolution They gave their energy, their confidence, their passion to the party because they wanted to reach according to their needs. We all want this, even in Britain, even in the NHS. This is in part what we've got. And so this is being what animates people, brings them to militancy and actual revolution. And then there was a necessity of a state, like Ian explained, because you can't go just from the way it was in the past up to production for need without a transition. And we are discussing this transition. And so the importance for us of all of this is that if we are serious about what we are doing, we are going to have to face such problems. This or something like this, it concerns every one of us. And so, yeah, just to finish that thinking round, the development of capitalism on the world scale achieves itself out of the dispossession of the rest of the world. And that dispossession happened in Russia, in the Soviet Union. It was backward because it was pillaged, because it was kept in obscurantism, because the West was doing its best to keep it out of the way and to keep it subjugated and submitted to beliefs and, you know, things which were not scientific. And so you've got development on one hand of the world and underdevelopment on the other, and one is a result of the other. And we have to stop talking as if somehow everybody is free to do what they want. We are not free. As long as we are, there is capitalism in the world. And the existence of the market, the capitalist market, meant that when Russia or Soviet Union developed, it had, if he was going to get anything apart from the things that he was producing, if he was going to get the other materials, he had to buy and sell, like everybody else at the moment. And so to buy and sell, you're on the market. And the market makes demand on you. And you cannot suddenly spirit up a level of production which is going to compete with the most advanced of the capitalist countries. This was one of the problems of the Soviet Union. You had to develop a capacity of production which could at least compete. So because it was not yet in socialism. And so, yeah, well, the long and the large of this, I would like to add, is that Trotsky doesn't complain. In fact, he was the most victimized person you can imagine in the world. He never speaks about what's happened to him, and he never complains about what's happening to him. Whilst we are discussing this in 1936, he was being hounded from one country to the other, and he was still finding the energy to talk about all these things. And studying the small bits of what was happening in the Soviet Union, where he had just been expelled from. This is an example of objectivity and of selflessness, which is not given justice by thinking that he was complaining. He's defending the principle of the revolution. Yeah, this is what I wanted to say.
Oh. I mean, I think that the other thing to remember, though, is that I had not been as aware of the fact that Russia survived the Great Depression, you know, from 29 to 30. Even Britain didn't really come out of it until 38, 39. Whereas Russia, because it was working far more together for its society and based on need rather than excessive profits, it came out of the depression much better. Its society was in a much better shape, whereas the British Empire, in particular, and British workers in particular, you know, we've almost blotted out things like the Jarrow March, the massive unemployment, the very real divide between the middle classes, who were not so affected by the depression, and the working classes, for whom poverty and mass unemployment was an absolute nightmare, and many went abroad. But the American capitalists, Henry Ford in particular, were funding the far right and the rise of the far right to attack communism because they didn't want workers' rights. They didn't want the support that the Soviet Union was doing, both by example in the success that they had, but also by supporting those people across the world who were trying to fight for their rights to free them from, by that time, American capitalism. You know, it was neo-colonialist while pretending that because it was a republic, it wasn't an empire. But America's always veered between isolationism and blatant colonialism, hasn't it?
And that, if I may add something to
that. Please do.
Yeah, the anti-Sovietism was something to behold. In my family, I was always told that Russia was a devil, and that was by people who had been, you know, people before me had been witness or had just come, had lived just after the Russian Revolution. And my family, they had a visceral hatred of communism, and they knew nothing about it. It was just, and then the capitalist France was the whole of France, like they do now with Russia. It was going on then when I was growing up. And so imagine what they were doing to Russia when it was trying to get some machinery or some technology. Ah, my God, it was like they do to China now. You know, you can't have these things. You know, you should stay in underdeveloped so that we can keep our hand on you. Yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah, which is why it's so weird, because I lived a very sheltered life where my parents were very pro-Russian, and I just wasn't aware until I went to university that there were people out there who didn't like Russia or who weren't bowled away by how fantastic, you know, the Russian cosmonaut program was, or, you know, how brilliant it was that this country had, you know, pioneered every single, you know, first in space, from the first man in space with Yuri Gagarin to the first walks, you know, the first spacewalks. I mean, that was the only reason for all the fuss about the man on the moon, is because that's the only thing that the Americans have ever won on in terms of the space race. And now they've just wiped it all out. You know, the whole thing, they've rewritten history, just as, you know, the Fourth Reich are busy rewriting history now. But none of that really takes away from the fact that the danger, you know, it's Russia's support and lead by example that is the reason for why people supported it. And, you know, it was the unwillingness of Stalin to fight. You know, he knew he had to fight in World War II on one front, rather than, you know, Churchill and the Americans, I never remember which one, it's Roosevelt, isn't it? They were desperate for them to open up two fronts and fight Japan on one side and the Germans on the other, which would have led to Russia's defeat. Yes?
Is it not so that when you see the Soviets going in space, like you very well mentioned, is it not so then they acquired the technology which surpassed the West?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the farce is that they always make the pretense that Russia must have stolen it from America, but they can't hide the fact that Russia went in first. Why? Because it was interested in technology that was effective. And this is where capitalism is gaudy. It's technology. You can look at what's happening in Ukraine at the moment. Yes, Russia is winning because its weaponry is more effective.
Susan, John wants to speak.
Yeah,
no, it's not really important. I haven't heard this before, that they wanted Japan to open a second front during the Second World War in Russia. I mean,
Yes. I'll find you a source for it. Okay, John?
Okay, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, the whole thing about why did America, you know, why is America the only country that's dropped the nuclear, you know, nuclear bombs twice? It's because Russia was winning against Japan when it did enter the war against Japan. But Japan, because of the atrocities that have been committed against both Russians and Chinese, they were afraid that they would be, you know, there would be the same Nuremberg trials that there were going that there were going on in Germany, because the atrocities the Japanese had committed were so horrific, but the atrocities in Nanking were so appalling. But they were the Emperor of Japan's son, yes, who became the emperor, would have been put on trial for that vile competition he had with his second in command for who could reach 100 chopped heads first. There were atrocities committed. There were experimentation on Chinese peasants and prisoners of war that rivaled anything that you would have seen in the Dr. Mengele experiments and things that were done. And they were kept very quiet. Most of what the British historians talk about is the starvation of, you know, British prisoners of war being kept on rations that barely managed to feed Japanese soldiers, never mind, you know, and obviously with bigger frames and more used to a Western diet, they could not cope with, you know, they felt like they were being systematically starved. But a lot of the privations that they had were down to the peasants being used, you know, having such a poor diet. Yes. Yeah. But the creation of the second front in Europe. Yes, they talk about second front in Europe, but actually what they were talking about was they wanted Russia to open up a second front on its, you know, Sino-Japanese border, the Japanese border. That's why you still get the Kuril Islands and all of that.
Never heard of that, sorry.
Okay, I will look it up for you.
Ah. Sorry, John wants to speak again, but they'll come in after John, yeah?
Yep.
Yeah, just briefly, you've got to be careful about the second front in Europe, the second front being launched by Europe and America, because you know, the Stalinophobes amongst the Trotskyists, they don't see it that way. They don't see that that this was a deliberate tactic. They don't think this was the case. They don't. So, you know, I found, much to my surprise, amongst some Trotskyists, it's not regarded as in the same way that I'd regard it, as it was almost deliberate. I'm pretty sure it was deliberate that they didn't open a second front, but it's not held uniformly within the Trotskyist movement, I think. The Stalinophobes will say that's just a Stalinist myth.
Right, that's interesting. What I was going to say about the Far East is that there was military action by the Soviet Union against Japan, wasn't there? In Manchuria.
Yep, that's the one that I was
also. I'll tell you, where did North Korea come from? There was no indigenous revolution in North Korea like there was in China. In North Korea, what happened is that the Soviet troops surrendered. Sorry, the Japanese troops surrendered to the Soviets above that parallel line, and they surrendered to the Americans south of it. So that division of Korea was there quite early on. That was how it ended up with the Japanese being driven out of Korea by imperialist and Soviet troops, and of course the Soviet troops withdrew quite quickly, but allowed the Korean Communist Party to take power as they left, and that's the starting point of North Korea. it wasn't a revolution in the same way as the Cuban Revolution or the Yugoslavian Revolution. It was a bit more like sort of Poland or Romania or whatever, you know, but it soon mushrooms into something slightly different because it's now...
Yalta 1945 conference. That's when Churchill specifically asked Stalin to open up the front against Japan.
Yes,
and it was they would have got, you know, the promise was that Russia would have its spheres of influence.
Mm-hmm. And Korea is where they divided as well.
Well, Korea was France basically losing and begging America to go in, whereas and fighting China, wasn't it? And Russia and China being aligned. But, you know, I think America, once it became secure in its in the petrodollar and the Bretton Woods Agreement, and realized that basically World War II had completely crippled the economies of all the countries in Europe, then they were going to be able to lay down the rules. And because they laid down the rules, they were able to manipulate the markets to ensure that by the time you get to the 70s, America could enforce the petrodollar, which has then basically kept them in the money. You know, that's why they have a 38, is it, trillion dollar debt and no worries whatsoever about continuing to bribe one country after another to fall like dominoes to attack Russia. And, you know, it's little list of who it knocks off next. You know, Syria having fallen, they're saying, you know, they only spent about $1 billion to destroy Syria. I mean, it was a shame it took 15, 20 years, but, you know, they got on eventually. I mean, it cost them less probably to destroy Iran, but a lot more to destroy Afghanistan. But they made a huge amount of money selling opium on the way. You know, the bloated American economy makes, you know, the excesses of the British Empire look like peanuts. But it's going to go down because I don't think China is not going to let American control of the IMF and the World Bank continue to destroy economies for it so that the corporations can keep carrying on destroying them. We're not looking at, and I think Trotsky was, but he never really, I never feel in his analysis of the system that he doesn't look at the financial control that was outside of Russia that had such an effect. I mean, you can, you know, if you look at Europe, for example, the EU has just lost the contract it thought it had arranged with Qatar because it insists on imposing its so-called humanitarian and European values on Qatar. And countries, understandably, are saying, what are you, you know, you're buying our resources. You don't own us or tell us how to live how our society should be run. And, you know, Brussels is sitting there, you know, van der Leyen is pulling her hair out, trying to work out why it is that people don't want her brand of nanny politics. But the reality is it's, you know, a bunch of Chihuahua states thinking that they can do what Blinken is doing, and Blinken is busy fomenting World War III. You look at the you know, the efforts to try and stage that military coup in South Korea.
Yeah.
You know, they were ready to go to war with North Korea. Just on the space, and you know, despite what they're lying about in the West, that particular plan it's been under wraps by the Biden team for more than 18 months.
Uh-huh.
It's only because it was so badly carried out at the last minute that it failed so badly because the South Korean people genuinely want reunification, but they want it peacefully. They do not want it. And North Korea has finally said, actually, we don't like your society and we don't want to be treated like as an American vassal, because their standard of living is only maintained by excessive amounts of work and profit that all goes to America. There are increasing countries who are looking at Ukraine and Israel and thinking, I don't want to be like them. I don't want, they don't want to be the next American proxy. It's not what it's shown in Disney. It's not what it's shown in the American media. It's not a land of freedom and democracy. It's a land of tent cities and debt and dying because you're bankrupted by the lack of Medicare. Sorry, Paul.
Yeah, Paul.
Going back to the chapter we were reading, I actually quite like that little portion. It's quite short compared to other portions we've been reading. I found it interesting because it basically culminated what we sort of read in the earlier chapters about how you need to get to a certain standard before you can actually go over to socialism and then communism. But the one thing that Cookie keeps highlighting is the way in which the bureaucracy itself keeps creaming off elements of the riches that come from that. And so for me as a Cookie, well, most of us here, I'm sure, the challenge is always going to be, how are you going to prevent that sort of degeneration of the state, betraying the revolution? And that's the ultimate question, isn't it? And, I did feel the need to just get back to the text. I thought we were going off on one a bit there, but
can I just say on that? I mean, I think that this has been a very good discussion because it's gone into depths that I think the worst of what we've been talking about is in the text in some sense, but it's in the depths of it. And we're talking about the underlying methodology and the understanding of, for instance, Russia that goes into that. And I mean, obviously, it doesn't stick exactly to the limits of what Trotsky discussed in the text. But I think underlying that, the questions about the nature about the state and the relationship of productive forces to the health of, or otherwise of the revolution, and the question of how you build socialism. And how you overcome this tendency to inequality, I think these have actually been explored in quite an interesting way in this discussion. And I mean, there are other obviously there's more to go in this chapter, but this is I think it's quite a good start actually personally. I do take your point that we are slightly off the text, but not really actually. We've not really gone. On completely outside its framework, I don't think.
I was going to say, I think the thing about bureaucracy is that bureaucrats have it's an immoral imperative, if you like, to siphon off part of the wealth of the system. Because eventually their role in society will be removed, is removed as the workers' revolution, if you like, eventually achieves a state of communism that doesn't require the bureaucracy to be this separate class with its own opportunities to self-reward, yes, to exploit. So it's about saying, well, what system can we introduce into the civil service that we require to make the state run in order to make workers sufficiently independent, yes, to have enough productivity so that everybody can share. And what, say, you know, what checks and balances do we put on the bureaucracy so that it does not become its own ruling class, or at least under ruling class? And I'm not sure that Trotsky ever addresses that, or does he, or is it that we have to rely on a Stalin to chop off a few heads and stamp out on the corruption that you are keen on, even if you don't approve of Stalin, Ian?
Well, he chopped off a few heads as well in his time, but yeah.
Yeah, but I'm teasing a bit, but it is that, you know, if Stalin didn't exist, would Trotsky have to create him in order to bring on the revolution in the way that he warns it may be undermined?
Our version of Stalin would be not the version that we got.
All right, but I'm just saying.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, but is it a valid point?
It's sort of. I think it's there in State and Revolution by Lenin, and Trotsky.
Yes.
You know, but I know what you're saying.
Paul.
I know what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, my issue with Stalin was that when it came down to it, he wasn't a revolutionary. It stopped his record, and that was all he wanted. That was that.
Yeah.
But the point about Trotskyism is to expand the revolution and to obviously be aware of all the contradictions and so on that take place at every stage of that, and that's what Trotsky does. But the point is, Stalinists don't want the permanent revolution. They call it socialism in one country. Mm-hmm. But they don't understand that would never work in the long run if everybody else is under capitalism. And that is the major difference between Stalinism and Trotskyism. I mean, you can joke about Stalin chopping heads off, but it was the Trotskyists they were chopping off.
Yeah, that's
right. So be careful where you go with that one.
Yeah, I know. I understand her point. I understand Susan's point now.
Anyway,
shall we wind up? It's getting close to 6 o'clock. If that's all right, I think this is probably a good discussion. We should. There are two more possible things we could do on this chapter. One is the last section. Obviously, there's two sections to follow, which is state capitalism and is the bureaucracy a ruling class, which are all very closely related. And we could do that for the next one. And then the final one is titled The Character of the USSR Not Yet Decided by History. And I think something went a bit wrong with the web rendering, and they put Not Yet Decided by History at the top of the chapter. And I don't think that is actually the title of the introduction at all. I think that's something got garbled in the way it was put on the web. But anyway, those two sections would make good. The second and the third section, and then the final section, would make good topics for a discussion in a few weeks. I mean, I think we should probably have a forum in a couple of weeks on something topical, something to do with Ukraine or Syria or Palestine, or possibly all three, because Trump will, in 2 weeks' time, just over 2 weeks' time, Donald Trump takes office on Tuesday the 21st. Our next meeting will be on the 19th, I think, which is just too short. Yeah, we could have a meeting then, if that's all right with comrades, yeah? Something to do with that. We'll have to discuss it at the branch meeting and decide exactly.
I think we should have a discussion post inauguration because of the threat of a coup around the Trump inauguration.
Why don't we have split it off for 3 weeks then and have
What I'm suggesting. Okay, if that's all right. Good. Yeah, or you know, because I know a week is in politics. It would be better to discuss it afterwards when we have seen, if you like, what is the worst that the Democrats and the CIA and the rest of them are going
what
to
are we doing in 3 weeks?
For an inauguration.
3 weeks will be after the Palestine demo, though.
Yes, but the, you know, the 60 days will be up for Israel. We will see much better how Israel's going to cope with its commitments or its land grab in both Lebanon and Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll also be able to see how the world settles down to the pact between Russia and Iran, and whether or not Israel...
Do we have a forum on all this in 3 weeks' time? And then we'll do the next deal, Trotsky, 2 weeks later, yeah? Is that right?
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Yeah, okay. Great stuff.
Yep.
Okay, I'm going to stop the recording.
Marie's got a question for you, sorry. Marie?
Yeah, it doesn't need to be recorded.